wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this December 11th Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick talks to Hunter Blair of the Economic Policy Institute about the Republican tax plan. Hunter Blair joined the Economic Policy Institute in 2016 as a budget analyst. He researches tax, budget, and infrastructure policy. Clayton Morgridge will, in his commentary, recommend that leftists try to rein in their moral outrage at Trump supporters and attempt to understand what there is in many people's lives that leads to Trumpism. Book mole Larry Bolden reviews new novel by Alice McDermott, The Ninth Hour. Spanning the 20th century, The Ninth Hour is the story of a widow and her daughter and the nuns who serve their Irish-American community in Brooklyn. And Mike Snedeker talks to journalist Debbie Nathan about her work as an investigative reporter for the ACLU of Texas. Nathan just published an article on December 9th for The Intercept titled, "They're Taking Everybody. Videos Show Texas Troopers Ripping Apart Immigrant Families During Traffic Stops." That will be at the end of the show. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting KBOO in programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour. And remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Hunter Blair.
Hunter Blair, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Hunter Blair is a budget analyst at the Economic Policy Institute, the EPI, in Washington, D.C., a progressive think tank. It publishes every 2 years, the book, The State of Working America. It's also free on the web, a dismal story of pain for working people, few good years, not many. Among many other of EPI's reports and policy proposals, they are aimed at improving the lives of the great majority of people who live in this country and, in fact, around the world. Hunter Blair, along with some colleagues, has been assigned to evaluate the Republican proposals for what Donald Trump describes as the greatest tax reform in history. Hunter, I've read quite a few of your almost daily reports that assess many of the specific provisions of the tax plan. I gathered you disagree with this self-described smartest man on earth. Tell us why.
Yeah, what it is certainly one of the greatest tax cuts for the rich and big corporations in history. But as far as their claims for benefiting the middle class or working families, we don't see any of that in this bill.
Tell us about the specific provisions and what they do. You know, there is going to be a tax cut for the middle class, they say.
Yeah, so in the initial years, there are some crumbs sort of thrown at the middle class, but then those are clawed back, and eventually there are actually tax increases in the Senate version of the bill, while the tax cuts for the big corporations remain permanent in the bill. At the end of the day, 62% of the benefits of the Senate version of this bill go to the top 1%.
62%. Remind us of the specific cuts that are being made, like eliminating the alternative minimum tax and the estate tax, which will apparently save especially real estate developers and especially Donald Trump. And maybe his savings could be as close to $1 billion over a 10-year period.
Yeah. In the Senate version, they double the exemption level for the estate tax. The estate tax currently exempts $5.5 million per person, so that's $11 million for a married couple. They're going to double that in the Senate version. In the House version, they eventually repeal all of the estate tax. And the estate tax only hits the top 0.2% of the wealthiest estates. So this is a massive giveaway to the rich.
And also the corporate income taxes. not only being brought down to a actually more reasonable figure, but they've set it up so that almost all companies will never pay the maximum. They're moving towards also expanding the tax break to almost all rich people will be paying much less taxes than the official rate. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the corporate tax cut, they're cutting it from 35% to 20%. Corporate taxes largely fall on rich shareholders and capital income in general. And so this is a massive giveaway to the top in and of itself. But then also, they've done something which, in the jargon, it's referred to as moving to territorial taxation. But what it really means is that the offshore profits of these big corporations is no longer going to be taxed in the U.S. And so this is going to incentivize even more offshoring of profits and jobs.
And what about the sort of pass-through provision that in Kansas, there was an expansion of the, quote, pass-through provision, and it turned out that the two highest-paid public servants in Kansas, that is the football coach and the basketball coach, at about $5 million a year, I guess, they decided to become corporations so that they could, in fact, save themselves huge amounts of money. And it looks like Kansas is going to become the United States. Every football coach, the big types, the CEO football coaches, they'll also become corporations and save themselves a huge amount of money.
Yeah, absolutely. So pass-throughs are companies that don't pay any income tax at the business level, like a corporation would. Instead, the income is just profits from that company are just passed through to the owners of the company. And so what Kansas did was they cut the state tax to zero on these type of pass-through entities. And so what the House tax bill is doing is it would, instead of paying the top individual income tax rate, pass-through owners would only be subject to, I think it's a 25% rate. And so like you say, in Kansas, this ended up with the head football coach and the head basketball coach calling themselves pass-throughs so that they could get a lower tax rate on their income. And if the House version of this bill, if the House version of that proposal in particular is passed, then there's going to be a cottage industry of lawyers and accountants that are going to get around anything that they put in the law to stop it, because it's such a big income wedge. And so you're going to have all sorts of very rich individuals that will no longer pay the top tax rate. They'll pay whatever this supposed new pass-through tax rate is.
Right, which will likely be lower than the tax rate for sort of average income people. It could well be that the rich, because they can hire these lawyers and do all of that, the shenanigans, will pay a lower percentage of their tax rate, depending on exactly where they set this pass-through, the percent of...
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And they will do that. There are so many provisions in the bills, and there are other things that they're doing, like in reading your materials, I know the EPI materials, I notice there's a proposal from the Labor Department to make sure that tips, that gratuities that used to go to the waiters and waitresses and other tip people, it would be the owner of the restaurant who could claim them.
Yeah, that's right. It's incredible that they're passing that at the exact same time that they're ramming through this huge corporate giveaway at the expense of people that rely on Medicaid and Medicare, all sorts of programs.
It's quite amazing. They're going to make a lot of enemies, it seems to me, but we'll be talking about that. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. I'm talking to Hunter Blair of the EPI, the Economic Policy Institute, a progressive think tank. His current assignment is to evaluate the Trump Republican tax plan. The tax plan is going to enrich the rich. They're going to use it, even if the middle class tax cut was real, and it isn't, they're going to use now the $1 trillion or $2 trillion expansion of the deficit, the deficit's expanding. Paul Ryan has said this on conference yesterday. I mean, what a gaffe and a mistake by him. He said the next thing on the Republican agenda is to get control of entitlements and cut them. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I think we've seen this play out time and time before. Republicans cut taxes and then come back and try to leverage the deficits that result from those taxes to claim that we absolutely have to gut Medicaid and Medicare and education and public investments. And like you said, I mean, Paul Ryan admitted that this is the plan, that next year they're coming for Medicaid and Medicare. And the Republican budget itself sort of gives the game away. Medicaid gets cut by $1.3 trillion and Medicare gets cut by half a trillion.
Well, this is their budget proposal. Their tax proposal is to give away money to the rich. Their budget proposal, even this time around, is to cut, quote, entitlement programs. That is the programs that, in fact, supplement older people's income, poor kids' medical care. None of that is of interest to these, I'm not sure what you would call them, monsters. But maybe they actually believe their rhetoric, and let's talk about that. They claim that all these tax cuts are going to lead to a great economic boom, high employment, high productivity. America is going to become the greatest again. What's the real story of what happens after these tax cuts?
There's no evidence that corporate tax cuts are going to trickle down to workers. You could look across international comparisons, recent American economic history, compare individual U.S. states, and you don't find evidence that corporate tax cuts are going to boost the wages of American workers.
Yeah, I mean, that experiment has been tried time and time again. What companies do, they don't invest because they have a lot of money. They'll either give it back to the rich shareholders or they put it into casino capitalism, that is, hedge funds and the rest, various kinds of new and more lucrative financial paper that Salomon Brothers and all the others create for them so they can get 4 or 5 or 8% on their money. And they just make more and more money. But there's no reason to produce more of almost anything because everything's in great surplus right now. Two-thirds of the world is too poor, actually, even to begin to provide the demand in this economy that they've created. They're not going to invest. It doesn't make any sense for them to actually invest in production.
Yeah, we already have what this corporate tax is supposed to engineer. The way the corporate tax cut is supposed to trickle down to workers is you get higher after-tax profits, and this boosts investment. It increases savings, which lowers interest rates, and eventually you get higher productivity, which trickles down to workers, but we already have near record high after-tax corporate profits. We have extraordinarily low interest rates, and yet over this business cycle, investment has been weak. And so doing more of the same isn't going to fix anything. And we know that CEOs are already saying that these corporate tax cuts are getting shoveled to shareholders, not workers.
This is Cable Radio, Bill Resnick talking to Hunter Blair of the Economic Policy Institute about the Republican tax plan. It's really quite disastrous, and in fact, it could actually destroy the economy that they claim they're going to boost because the continuous fall in income for the majority of people, it seems to me, just reduces effective demand, and ultimately we begin cascading into deflation and deep depression. That seems to me a possibility if they get away with what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, we've had decades of wage stagnation for the vast majority of workers, and it solves no economic problem faced by this economy at all to just continue to cut taxes for the rich and big corporations.
It seems to me that a lot of corporations who are allegedly productive, they're all in the finance industry because they all have these big pools of money and they have financial experts working for them, like even the college endowments and the rest of those things. They manage their money in order to get like 8% or 10%. It makes no sense to produce anything if you can make 8% or 10% on your hedge fund money. But is that right?
Okay. Yeah, finance has ballooned as a share of the economy. It contributes to rising inequality. It has sparked, obviously, major crises very recently. And despite how much it's ballooned in the economy, it, as a share of the economy, a lot of the trades are totally unproductive. And that makes a financial transaction tax vital to progressive tax reform.
Under Blair, the Economic Policy Institute, let's switch gears. Taxes are important. Taxes provide the resources for doing things that are necessary. Why don't we go through fairly briefly the Congressional Progressive Caucus proposal, the Black Caucus proposal, much of the Sanders proposal. It would be easy to raise quite considerable sums of money to do things that we really need. Why don't you specify both the proposed tax changes and the things that this country and the planet so desperately need right now?
Yeah, I would say that a progressive version of tax reform would honestly basically be the exact opposite of what we're seeing. Instead of gutting Medicaid and Medicare to pay for tax cuts for the rich and big corporations, we should be instituting higher and more tax rates further up the income distribution. We should be raising more revenue from the corporate sector, and we should be making the rates on earned and unearned income equal to each other, a big part of which involves actually raising more revenue from the corporate sector.
And things like the financial transaction tax, which would be very small but still raise large amounts of money, but would also decrease the vast amount of speculation and churning by which very well-placed people with extremely fast computers can just basically take things out of the economy by playing changes that they know is happening very, very rapidly to essentially what is tax everybody else just through high-capacity computers.
Yeah, that's right. And FTT is an incredibly important progressive tax tool. It would clamp down on unproductive trading, and it would stop the socially inefficient redistribution we've seen to the financial sector.
It's really immense how much of the U.S. surplus goes to absolutely unproductive people who just game the economy. And it becomes worse and worse over the years. And the Republicans are sort of expanding that in so many ways that we can't list. Let's just talk for a second about what it would pay for and what our real needs are, for example, in reducing greenhouse gas emissions and saving the planet, something small like that. But there's so many needs, right? Infrastructure is falling apart. Why don't you list them?
We can pay for needed public investments. We can pay to expand Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, expand infrastructure. And one thing that should be crucial to a progressive tax reform would be a robust carbon tax that can really combat climate change by reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Especially if the money used is partly distributed to the poor or to the bottom 50%, but partly for building public transport, changing urban patterns, creating an energy system that's a distributed energy system, rather than the extremely expensive and unreliable energy system that we are moving into, especially in an era of climate change. There's so much to be done. Hunter, you're the talent. Comment on whatever you think is important and we'll sign off.
We know carbon taxes are on their own regressive, and so part of a carbon tax in a progressive tax reform should be rebated to low and moderate income households, and then the rest should really be used to make green investments that we need to combat climate change.
There's a lot to be done, and it would employ millions of people in really decent, productive, contributory jobs. What can be better? But the Republicans think the finance industry has to be further fed. Well, Hunter, it gets more interesting all the time. So, Hunter Blair, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks for having me.
Right. So long.
is Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. What if we all stopped paying taxes? And that's a comment from below rather than what the rich are trying to pull on us this time. Well, coming up on The Old Mole later in the program, Mike Snedeker talks to journalist Debbie Nathan about her work as an investigative reporter for the ACLU of Texas. Nathan has just published an article on December 9th for The Intercept titled, "They're Taking Everybody. Videos show Texas troopers ripping apart immigrant families during traffic stops." We'll also hear from book mole Larry Bolden, who will review the new novel by Alice McDermott, The Ninth Hour. But next we have Clayton Morgridge with a commentary on what the leftists can do to understand how Trump has so much support. Clayton?
Thank you, Denise. Yes, well, a great deal of the opposition to Trump and Trump supporters is couched in the register of moral outrage. Some of it is ridicule, making fun of Trump's appearance and his obliviousness to demonstrable facts, as well as the ignorance of some of his supporters. We lament the danger he and his supporters pose to democracy and peace, and the hatefulness of what they say and do about women, people of color, and the poor. One might almost suppose that the left these days is united primarily around hatred for Trump and people who support him, even though we say that love trumps hate. Trumpists find solidarity in their disgust for the left, whom they call libtards and snowflakes. But it would be nice if the left was united by something better than hatred or even moral outrage. There's no denying that shared moral outrage feels good. It's a way of declaring oneself to be on the right, that is, the left, side of history, and in solidarity with like-minded others. But it only drives the wedge deeper between us and people who are inclined to support Trumpism, convincing them that we live in a different moral universe from them, and that our only political wish is to silence them and render their desires and aspirations null and void in political decision-making that affects their lives. Of course, there are Trump supporters we could never reach because their real material interests, their investments and professions, stand to benefit from tax cuts and increased military spending. But we should not give up on working-class Trump voters, even if they have intolerant views that we find reprehensible. We need a strategy for eventually bringing everyone who is not a capitalist around to the understanding that capitalism is the enemy and not other members of the working class. Trump supporters are often represented on the left as too lazy and stupid to think beyond the brainwashing they have received from Fox News and the social media of the alt-right. The right-wing media have certainly managed to focus and give content to the discontent that Trumpists feel, but people believe what they believe in order to make sense of their lives. We need to ask what it is about the lives of millions that makes right-wing rhetoric make sense to them. What underlies the hatred of Trumpists for immigrants, people who cannot support themselves, people of color, and the direction of the country under mainstream political leadership? Hatred grows out of fear. For hatred is a way to redeem fear, to make it proactive rather than merely reactive. It turns flight into fight, and fight feels better than flight. So what are Trumpists fearful of? The reality is that they are being systematically fleeced by neoliberal capitalism that has made wages stagnant, while good jobs that can give a person a sense of getting ahead and doing something worthwhile are vanishing over the horizon. Policies affecting their lives are made in big cities, far away by people very different from themselves professionally, economically, and culturally. Moreover, it appears to them that the cultural ground they stand on is shifting underfoot, shaking their confidence in their right to be who they are. This bears on the problem of race. Our recent economic history of massive inequality and social disruption has left many people in rural and Rust Belt America without a secure sense of belonging in the world. Now, if they are white, then given the history of institutional racism in this country going back to slavery, they inevitably get some of their sense of identity from the mere fact that they are not black, that is, that they are white. So as the complexion of the nation changes, many who often unconsciously regard themselves as white feel threatened by the increasing numbers of people of color and by what looks to them like liberal policies of preferring them through policies of immigration and welfare. Now, we can protest and tell them that they ought to feel that they ought not to feel that way. But when we do so, they feel they are being preached at by people who do not share their lives. In a similar way, people who have grown up with their sense of self rooted in traditional gender relations can also feel their life world coming apart as those relationships are challenged by the increasing visibility and legitimation of the LGBTQ movement. Now, it's important to understand that these perceptions and fears are in varying degrees unconscious to those who have them, or are conscious only in partial and distorted ways. People who think falsely that people on welfare are mostly black and Hispanic and lazy to boot do not know that this belief is a rationalization of their own fragile sense of identity that depends on feeling superior as, quote, white, unquote, to people who are not white. Can we, on the left, let go of the assumption that our truth and our justice is so obvious that only people who are stupid and intellectually lazy or just plain evil could possibly fail to see it? Not only does this attitude, by casting ourselves as superior to the stupid and ignorant masses, poison our message so that only those already on our side will hear us, but we blind ourselves to the real reasons for Trump's appeal to a big chunk of the electorate. I suggest that what we see as their stupidity is not really a lack of native intelligence, but rather the paralysis of their intellects by fear and anger, leaving them unable to do more than lash out with alternative facts and simple-minded slogans that justify and express their anger. The philosopher Spinoza wrote, "I have labored carefully not to mock human actions, nor to lament, nor to curse them, but to try to understand them." Unquote. When we mock, lament, or curse someone, we cannot understand him or her. We have reduced the complex person who is embedded in a many-sided social situation to a demonic and isolated caricature, someone who is either a moron or is evil for no other reason than the perverse desire to do evil. Notice, though, that refusing to mock, lament, or curse what people do does not rule out objecting to what they do, or criticizing it, or prohibiting it, or even trying to stop it by force. But all these actions will be more effective if they are done with an understanding of how the cultural and political landscape looks and feels to the people whose actions we are objecting to and trying to prevent. The fact that Trumpism and alt-right views are deeply rooted in unconscious fears means that reasoned arguments will have very limited value, especially on people who have been committed to their views for a long time and who live in communities of like-minded people. We can hope, though, that younger members of those communities can be persuaded. But that will require us to develop and teach a positive and vivid vision of a better world, one that is powered by the will to cooperate rather than the will to dominate. And we need to learn to teach these things with an understanding of the people we are addressing and with as little mocking, lamenting, and cursing as humanly possible. I'm Clayton Morgeridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Susie and the Banshees, Cities in Dust. Coming up on the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO Radio, Mike Snedeker talks to journalist Debbie Nathan, this will be at the end of the hour, about her work as an investigative reporter for the ACLU of Texas. She has an article out now on The Intercept. They're taking everybody. Videos show Texas troopers ripping apart immigrant families during traffic stops. But next up, we have our book mole, Larry Bolden, who's here to review the new novel by Alice McDermott, The Ninth Hour. Larry?
There is hunger. Were I to try to summarize Alice McDermott's shimmering new novel, The Ninth Hour, I think I would choose that one simple line. I've read all of McDermott's superbly crafted novels, and I think it is fair to say that she's had a long and tumultuous relationship with Catholicism. This novel centers in on the lives of a small order of nuns, the Little Sisters of the Poor, and of a woman who works in the laundry of the convent. The woman's name is Annie, and the novel begins when Annie's husband, Jim, is preparing to commit suicide. Having been discharged from his train job for unreliability and insubordination, he sees nothing but bleakness ahead and opts instead for the silence of death. Sister Sansevier, a little nursing sister of the sick poor, happens on the scene shortly after a fire caused by the gas Jim used to accomplish his suicide. It is she who tends to Anne and finds work for her in the convent laundry as she prepares for the birth of the daughter she's carrying when Jim dies. The sister also tries to quickly arrange a funeral and burial in consecrated ground before it is discovered to have been a suicide. Unfortunately, the death is discovered to be a suicide before the burial can be completed, and although the couple has purchased side-by-side lots in the Catholic cemetery, his manner of death precludes the Catholic burial, causing Sister Sansevier to remark, "It would be a different church if I were running it." The little girl, Sally, is raised in the laundry where her mother works under the supervision of Sister Illuminata. Sally is a joy to all the sisters, and her mother becomes an indispensable assistant to the aging, arthritic Sister Illuminata. There are several interweaving stories in this lovely tale. While McDermott is quite obviously in many ways a critic of religion in general and Catholicism in particular, her descriptions of the little sisters are warmly and sympathetically drawn. Sally is especially loved by Sister Lucy and often trails after her as she nurses her many poor patients, quoting from the book. Sister Lucy told Sally that a good husband was a blessing. A good husband who went to work every day and didn't drink away his salary or lose it at the racetrack, didn't beat his children or treat his wife like a slave. But a rare blessing at that. She said even a good man will wear his wife thin. She said even a good wife might transform herself into a witch or a lush, or worse, an infant or an invalid, in order to keep her very good husband out of her bed. Sister Lucy said, "A woman's life is a blood sacrifice. This was," she reminded Sally, "our inheritance from Eve." Close quote. McDermott's sympathies lie with the women. Although her obvious feminism is not bitter or man-hating, Sister Jean, one of the younger nuns, tells the story of Jean Jugan, who one day comes across a blind woman who has been put out on the streets by her family. Quote, "Jean Jugan took the woman to her house, bathed her and fed her. She tucked the old lady into her bed and moved a pallet to the attic just above her head, where Jean Jugan slept within earshot of the poor soul." Close quote. She then comes across another woman who has been abandoned and takes her in, and then another, and another. As word gets out, people around the town begin to bring their old folks to Jean. Other good women hear of Jean's good work and ask if they can help. Again, quoting from the book, "Some of these good women moved into Jean's attic too, so they would be available day or night. The community expanded. The number of old folks who were cared for grew and grew. Jean Jugan went to the priest. She asked if the women could form a religious community of their own to help guide their lives as they did this good and difficult work. They held a meeting in Jean's attic, and there they drew up their plan to become the Little Sisters of the Poor." Close quote. Jean receives a large donation from a man, allegedly Charles Dickens, who wrote that she was the holiest person he had ever met. And quoting again, "But all the while Good Jean Jugin was busy doing her work. The priest who had advised her was off scheming. He went to Rome and told them he was the one who started the order. He said he was the one who found the first blind widow on the street, and he was the one who told Jean Jugin to take care of her. He was the one who invited the other women to help out, and the priests in Rome fell for it. They made him the head of the order, and they put a plaque on Jean Jugin's house that said, "Here, Father so-and-so founded the Little Sisters of the Poor," close quote. Furthermore, he preferred a very young nun in the order whom he liked better than Jean, and he put her in charge. There are so many lovely little vignettes in this novel, including one about how Sally decides to follow the lead of the nuns who have helped raise her, and against her mother's wishes decides to go off and join another order. I'll not tell you how this story plays out, except to say that McDermott seems always to find ways to champion the women, mothers, and nuns, and she does so with such lovely and wise stories. I think McDermott is one of the best writers alive today. I recommend all of her works to you, and especially this 2017 novel, The Ninth Hour. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Awake now after that Sonic Youth extended taste of Inhuman here on the Old Mole Variety Hour, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, and it is listener supported community radio. We've worked out a technical magistry here, thanks to our station manager Derek, and we have Debbie Nathan on the phone with Mike Snedeker to talk about her new article and the issues occurring in the I'm hearing, is that okay? Okay. the issues that are happening down in Texas with Border Patrol. Mike, you want to take it from here?
Yes. This is the second part of a two-part series about the front lines of Donald Trump's advance into our culture, the Mexican border. 2 weeks ago, we had Jim Smith talking about the changes in laws that have gradually tightened life for anyone coming into this country since the mid-90s. This time, we're going to talk to Debbie Nathan about life on the ground all along the Mexican border. Debbie's a veteran investigative reporter who now lives in Brownsville, Texas, works for the ACLU of Texas. She put up a piece called "They're Taking Everybody" on The Intercept yesterday. It features fine writing, but the most striking thing about it is the video clips of Texas state troopers stopping people on the road. They're like found horror movie films, showing families being torn apart along dusty highways. Debbie Nathan's piece features dash cam photos, which state troopers in Texas are now required to take whenever they stop somebody. So what you'll see would be the picture of a car in front of a state trooper's car, and you'll see the state trooper approaching the car and asking for papers. The usual purposes for the stops are pretextual. The ones in Debbie's clip show people being stopped for on a dubious account of a broken taillight, other people being stopped for having tinted windows that were a shade too dark. And then you'll see people being taken, men, and in one case a mother, being taken right out of the car, placed into a police car, and driven off, leaving people who are unable to drive or have no driver's license out in the middle of a road in their car all alone. It's a striking stuff. And Debbie shows how they see kind of a stable border life that involved people going back and forth across the border has been totally disrupted, not so much by ICE or the federal forces that make an impression here in Portland when they try to meet quotas by going to the courthouse and waiting for people, but these are state troopers, and they have no obligation at all to turn anyone over to federal forces, but they're now doing so. They're doing so apparently with relish. The numbers of people who have been deported abruptly or summarily are increasing, and the number of stops have become so pervasive. There are people being surveilled in ways that are unknown in any other part of this country. There are, for example, cameras high in the sky. And a woman who took her boy off to urinate at the debut of a baseball stadium, where there were 3,000 or 4,000 people crowding into a baseball stadium, was caught by a camera watching her 100 yards away from the baseball field. And troopers swooped down on her because she fit some sort of paradigm that led to her being actually stopped and eventually deported. So there's a tremendous amount of law enforcement money expended on forces at the state level and federal level, and in Texas at least, an eager compliance with federal laws, even when there is no obligation whatsoever to notify federal authorities. And the federal authorities used to function under what they called a catch-and-release program, where if they caught somebody who didn't have their papers but had no warrants outstanding and who had a steady job and who were part of a family, they would release them. That's no longer in effect. So now, as you'll see vividly in the videos shown on Debbie's Intercept piece, they're taking people and happily increasing their numbers. Personally, I think that it's such an easy way for law enforcement to go about its daily business rather than do dangerous things like catch murderers or rapists. It's very easy to just patrol highways along the border and stopping anybody who looks dark and who doesn't have a fancy car.
So basically, and we'll post this article. We're planning to do that. The article details the stories in text form, as well as you said, has a sampling of many of the videos that are caught through the dash cam. And So we'll make that available to folks. But essentially, and Debbie's work, she's done a lot, you know, decades of work on the U.S. and Mexico border. Is it your sense that she is saying, as you said, she's elaborating that things have become there's less ease in moving across the border for all people at this point?
And there's an atmosphere of terrific fear. There's a generally pervasive sense that it's dangerous to go outside. People are afraid to go shopping. People are nervous about riding bikes, for example. People have been caught on their bikes, thinking, if I ride bikes, I'll be able to avoid the authorities. That doesn't work. So it's really sapping the quality of life in many ways. Children are not getting exercise. People are not moving around. Business of all sorts of commerce has declined. There's a pervasive fear that anybody might be grabbed at any time that is having a profound effect, certainly in East Texas. And one of the points of Debbie's piece is that West Texas used to be another world. It is another world. East Texas is much like the old South. It's wet. It grew cotton. It's densely populated. West Texas is more like cowboys. It's drier, deserty. There's El Paso and Juarez, but otherwise not much. But the West Texas is now, due to this huge infusion of money into the Border Patrol, has become another place where life is risky. If you're dark-skinned, you can be stopped even whether or not you're illegal. And if you're not here by permission, the kind of easy crossing of that border and that bridge is long gone. And even if you're watching yourself, you can be caught. Now, I know that the trolls on The Intercept have celebrated the fact they think that simply because somebody is here, that makes them a criminal, because even though they haven't done anything at all destructive. And they're happy about that. But the Mexican border has a very low crime rate. There's no record of any terrorist ever having entered this country via the Mexican border. It's an enormous distraction, you know, founded on racism that has really savaged the economies, not of U.S. towns, as well as Mexico towns all along the border.
And it sounds like, you know, if all of that money is coming into that area, this is going to be something that folks want to hold on to. It's like the war on drugs. It's an economic boon for law enforcement. And in some ways, then that reverberates through the city, but obviously not impacting the communities that are being most harmed by it.
Well,
the economic infusion, that is.
Well, just like the Big Bend National Park is a place for bird watchers. Love to go. If you're a cop watcher, the border can't be beat. There's every imaginable type of law enforcement officer, several different sorts of federal officials, custom officials, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms officials, and every form of state trooper, Texas Rangers. And they're all there in great numbers, and they all have new equipment. It's a thriving law enforcement world, no doubt about it.
Well, we will. Any final points to make regarding this before we close out the show?
I guess the point that I've been left with in my talks with Debbie and reading her article is how there's a pervasive, dull, low-level nightmare of daily life happening now all along the border. And, of course, nothing stays permanent. It will resolve one way or another. But life down there is qualitatively worse than it was 2 years ago.
Well, thank you, Mike. We, of course, will hear from you again with The Left and the Law. And this is Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I want to thank our guests. Today, Bill Resnick talked with Hunter Blair about he's from the Economic Policy Institute. They talked about the Republican tax plan, Clayton Morgridge, our very own mole, talking about the importance of setting aside our moral outrage at Trump supporters in an attempt to understand what there is in many people's lives that lead to Trumpism. And, of course, we want folks to come to our left side. So let's try to think a little bit more about how we can build our movement. And book mole Larry Bolden reviewed Alice McDermott's Ninth Hour. We can find all of this on our webpage in the next couple of days, kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour. Mike Snedeker, again, thank you for being so good on the fly to talk about Debbie Nathan's article on The Intercept. It's called "They're Taking Everyone, Everybody." Videos show Texas troopers ripping apart immigrant families during traffic stops. We will have that posted on the on our webpage. Well, this is Denise Morris for The Old Mole. We're going to wrap it up, and we will be back next week. And thanks to our engineer as well for all of her gymnastics this morning, Patricia Kohlberg. Thank you.